From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll examine Milwaukee's K-12 ecosystem across all three sectors and how it impacts student outcomes. Then we'll look at the lawsuit trying to stop the I-94 expansion project.
It's going to fail to achieve its stated congestion reduction and safety goals. It's going to increase air and noise pollution. It will increase deaths and serious injuries from collisions. That's from the project's own data.
Plus, we'll talk with historian John Gerda about his Milwaukee guide based on his own tours of the city.
My hope is that they kind of come back with an enlarged sense of what Milwaukee is and who Milwaukee is, and also kind of a sense of the diversity and the vitality.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski, thanks for joining us. The I-94 expansion project is facing a lawsuit. We'll hear from one lawyer who argues the project will not be good for Milwaukee later in the show. We'll start with this. In the 1990s, Milwaukee was at the center of education reform with the establishment of the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program, followed by charter schools a few years later. The idea behind the parental choice movement was that the school system at the time was not serving children well. However, a new report finds there's little evidence that the average child in Milwaukee receives a higher quality education today. The Wisconsin Policy Forum dives deep into this data in their report, Roll Call. To share the report's findings, I'm joined by Wisconsin Policy Forum Deputy Research Director, Sarah Shaw. Sarah, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for taking the time to be here.
So glad to be with you.
So this report called Roll Call is a very comprehensive deep dive into Milwaukee's K-12 educational ecosystem. But before we get into it, let's talk about the actual system of Milwaukee schools that you evaluated for this report.
Sure. So we were describing what are the options available to students and how has that changed? Because it used to be and is the case in many places that you have your traditional public schools and then you have potentially some private schools that parents may pay to attend. And that's really not the case in Milwaukee, where we have a robust public school sector, traditional public schools, but also charter schools within MPS, Milwaukee Public Schools, and also outside of MPS. Then we have the private schools, and within those private schools, you might have students who are paying to attend, but you also might have students who are using state-funded tuition vouchers, so publicly funded students attending private school. And those are the three biggest sectors that we see here in Milwaukee now.
And those private schools under the MPS umbrella, you categorize that differently, right? Because I know for talking about the wider MPS conversation to make these distinctions can be a little confusing sometimes.
Yeah, so those private schools are outside of MPS entirely.
Okay.
And then we have charter schools, which you could either be authorized by MPS, meaning that it's the MPS board that gives the go-ahead on whether the school can operate or not, but the school itself is run independently. Or you might have what are called independent charter schools that are authorized in Milwaukee either by UWM or by the Common Council. And those are authorized by those entities and also run independently. So we distinguish between what we call non-instrumentality charter schools within MPS, which is a nice mouthful, or these independent charter schools that are authorized by UWM or the Common Council.
Okay, yeah, so definitely a lot of areas to keep track of. And this report breaks down a lot of big themes within these different sectors. So before we get into some of the data points, I want to talk about the big shift that happened. This report that you worked on is all about the current state of Milwaukee's K-12 schools 3 decades after the city became a national leader in overhauling our K-12 education system. So what was the state of the school system 3 decades ago, and what exactly were we overhauling, you know, to make this dramatic change?
Right. So part of the impetus for this report is that it's 30 years out from when some of these major systemic changes were starting around how we organize our schools. And the first really big one is that Milwaukee was the site of the first parental choice program in the country, what's sometimes referred to as a voucher program. So these are the programs where state funds are used to provide tuition vouchers to students to attend private school on public money. money. And the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program was the first in the country of its kind. So that was kind of big structural change, number one, that we're now using public funds to send kids to private school or to offer that option for families. And then not long afterwards, we have Minnesota instituted the first charter schools, and Wisconsin was actually second in line behind that. So Milwaukee is the site not only of those very first tuition voucher programs, but also the site of many of the country's first charter schools. And the initiation of both of these is what makes that 1990s period really an epicenter for just a lot of shifts happening in the Milwaukee K-12 landscape that really made us stand out nationally.
Gotcha. So there's so much information to unpack in your 50-plus page report. Obviously, we don't have time to go into depth about all of it, but we'll do our best to hit upon some of the main topics. And I'd like to start with enrollment, and particularly enrollment decline, right?
Yes. So we started with census data of just looking at the number of youth in the city overall, not even looking at schools yet. So the number of youth under the age of 18 in Milwaukee has dropped by 27%. So we have, that's compared 2020 to 2000. So over that 20-year period, we now have over 20,000 fewer Black children in the city, over 22,000 fewer White children in the city, although an additional over 11,000 Hispanic children. So there's been some real demographic shifts, and we see that happening in the schools as well. So it's declining birth rates and net migration that get us this overall 27% decline, but we don't see the school sectors feeling the impact of that decline evenly. So the traditional Milwaukee public schools are bearing the brunt thus far of that decline. From 2006 to 2024, the MPS enrollment declined by a third. So that's a major decrease in the number of kids attending traditional MPS schools. At the same time, however, we had increases in enrollment for both the charter schools, those within the district and those outside of the district, and the private choice programs. So the charters more than doubled over the same time period in their enrollment, and private choice increased, participation increased by 90%.
And as the city has lost youth, the overall student population, as you mentioned, is becoming less White and more diverse, but also high rates of childhood poverty. That continues to increase, right?
The rates that we looked at, we didn't necessarily measure over time how those have increased, but we do see overall that the level of need in the city increases across the sectors such that now demographically the sectors are actually quite similar in terms of the students that they serve, that whether we're looking at traditional MPS schools or the charter schools or the private choice programs, we have at least 90% students of color in all three of these sectors. We have at least 75% of students being classified as economically disadvantaged across all three. We have increasing percentages of English learners between 12 and 15%, depending on the sector. So these are all kind of those markers of, as you said, greater diversity in our schools, which brings a lot of strengths and also brings more barriers for our traditional school system, regardless of sector, to really be making sure that they're serving kids well.
Right. So as we're talking about student enrollment and the distribution of Milwaukee students across all different sectors, how does the distribution of students factor into some of the larger issues such as funding and resources?
Yeah, so funding follows children in many of the state's funding formulas based on simply the number of kids. So when we're seeing declining enrollment, that's typically bad news for, in this case, the district's budget, because the district is where we're seeing that enrollment decline hit the most. As the overall youth enrollment does decline in Milwaukee, we may start seeing it hit the other sectors as well. And certainly it means that at minimum, there's now more competition for a smaller pie of kids to be able to serve. So on a per pupil basis, whether it's our MPS schools, our charter schools, or our private schools, everyone's tracking their enrollment because of dollars following the kid on a per pupil basis. There's also additional funding that follows children based on their needs. So there's state and federal funds designated for students living in poverty, for students who are English learners, for students who have special needs. Those pots of money have different levels of funding attached to them. So for example, if you have more students with disabilities, which MPS does, you get more money for that, but the amount of money that they're receiving is far below the amount that they actually need to be able to educate those children well. So you get into a little bit of push-pull of, okay, I'm getting more, but the needs are greater. And so actually, I'm ending up needing to shift money away from my general funds to be able to provide these mandated and good services for kids.
Right. And I want to dive a little deeper into students with special needs. MPS is bearing the brunt of that. Did the data show like why this is the case? And you know, some of the consequences of, as you mentioned, having to shift around those funds when it comes to student resources and outcomes for these students in our classrooms.
Yeah, our data didn't show us necessarily the why behind it, but you're absolutely right about that concentration. So I mentioned in many ways the sectors are quite demographically similar. The big exception there is students with disabilities. So the charter schools are educating in their student body about 11% of students with disabilities. MPS is up at 20%. So in the entire traditional MPS student body, 20% of kids have an identified disability and that the district then has the mandate legally to serve. Our private schools, we have less good data on the percentage of students with disabilities who are educated there. We know that the state data is an undercount. Our best estimate is that it's somewhere around the level of the charter schools, certainly not as high as MPS is. And that does create challenges for MPS or for any of our charter schools that are serving and it also a high percentage because at least at the state level, the underfunding there is at 30%, meaning that for every dollar that a district is spending on a student's special needs, they're only receiving 30 cents on that back.
And when we talk about overall student outcomes, the data shows there is little evidence that the average Milwaukee child receives a higher quality education today compared to the core premise of parental choice, that whole movement in the 90s. Is that a good summary statement that outcomes for most students today, it's not good?
So there were so many people who are contributing to that parental choice moment in the 90s that it's hard to nail it down to a single goal. I think we can point to kind of two ones that often come up. The first was being able to expand the number of options available for families, and particularly low-income families of color. And by that measure, we do see, as we said, increased diversity across sectors, increased kind of voting with their feet to go not just into a single sector, but spread across. So one might say by that measure, we have seen one of those original goals kind of made progress toward. The hope, of course, was that in being able to exercise more choice, that we would see improved outcomes across the board. And while we don't have specific measures that can take us all the way back to 1990 and say year over year, here's how we see things changing, the evidence that we do have doesn't suggest that the kind of structural changes that we made to the system resulted in structural changes to outcomes for kids. So while there are pockets of success and we saw some pre-pandemic improvements, where we are in 2024 doesn't look very great compared to where we were, say, back in 2009.
Okay. Yeah. A big span of time there as well. I'm just going to take a moment to reintroduce you. You're listening to Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski here with Sarah Shaw of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We're going over their recent report called Roll Call. 2024 core public funding per student for schools in Milwaukee is now largely even, according to your data. But this report shows that funding and other looming financial challenges will remain and honestly probably be on our doorstep fairly quickly here. So can you explain why this is? I'm sure people have questions about it, especially after we just passed two referendums pretty close together.
Yeah, there's a number of factors going into the current financial state of Milwaukee's schools across all three sectors. So first, we had pre-2024 some concerns about per pupil funding being even with, we compared it to two decades prior, looking at 2024 versus 2004. The fact that in 2024 we're largely even with where we were in 2004, adjusted for inflation, is primarily due to two factors. The first is the 2020 MPS referendum. So that brought MPS's per pupil revenue levels back up to where they had been in 2004. And the reason they were falling prior to that was a combination of enrollment decline and also state funding failing to keep pace with inflation. So that's on the traditional public school side. And then our charters and our private choice programs received a boost in the 2023-25 state budget that brought them back up to those 2004 levels. That's not to say that 2004 is any kind of magic date. It just gave us a useful barometer for where are we relative to, say, two decades ago. The 2024 MPS referendum means that MPS will now be receiving additional revenue for 2025 and beyond. And that will no doubt be of help to the district as they are contemplating a number of financial challenges, including the potential for continued enrollment decline, which we've said it really creates a lot of strain for the district. We don't know how much that enrollment decline will end up affecting the other two sectors as well if the pressure starts to build there. The reason that we really anticipate seeing financial difficulties come back and even grow further, despite these boosts that have happened, is we look at the number of students per school and the number of school buildings. And there was a proliferation of school buildings when all of these sectors were kind of taking off and we get more publicly funded buildings on the books. But then we get this big enrollment decline and the number of school buildings has really not moved that much, even as the number of kids has dropped. So that's stretching the available number of dollars across this pretty large quantity of school buildings, which then lowers the amount of funding per school, lowers the amount of funding per student at each school, and is probably not going to be that easily resolved because it's not spread evenly across the city. We have schools that are over-enrolled. We have schools that are under-enrolled. Figuring out how to manage some sort of potential right-sizing, which is a scary word for people, is really tricky because you're dealing with generational, geographic, school culture, community culture. There's just so much in there. And yet the current situation looks increasingly untenable for being able to provide adequate resources for students at all of these different school buildings.
In the span of this 3 decades that you examined, were there any areas of encouraging progress?
I think the fact that we see bits of progress on the performance front prior to the pandemic. So we looked, we used report card ratings, and we also looked at a national data set called the Nation's Report Card to give us a sense of kind of both on a national scale and statewide, did we see movement? And there were some promising signs there. I hesitate to attach too much woohoo to
it. Yeah.
Because we are starting from a place of real deficit. But there were some signs that there were schools that were really figuring out how to best serve kids. And that I think gives us the option of thinking of, well, can we scale some of those solutions to elsewhere in the city? The pandemic, like in so many other places, really hurt that progress. In some cases, stalled it. In other cases, reversed it. Mm-hmm. So when we looked at that national data, 7% of MPS traditional schools and MPS charter school eighth graders were proficient in math in 2022, which is exactly the same percentage that were proficient in math in 2009. And that's just really, really discouraging.
Yeah. Yeah. On that note, in what other areas does Milwaukee and our school system stand out nationally?
So when we look at the largest school districts in the country, we looked at the 120 largest school districts. Milwaukee has quite a high child poverty rate. We were 7th highest in the nation in the most recent data that we examined. That, to a certain extent, is going to be a factor in seeing our scores be so low relative to other districts. We also saw, however, that the gap between Milwaukee and other districts nationally was widening over time in a way that didn't track with how the child poverty rate was changing. So we do think that Milwaukee starts further behind the starting line than other places, but also doesn't seem to be growing as much as it could if we look at where other places are. So that was one big place of just kind of what's our starting point. And then the other place that we really stand out is in the gap in outcomes for our white students as compared to our Black students. And this comes up across virtually any measure that you want to take, whether it's graduation rate, whether it's proficiency rates, whether it's access to schools or attendance at schools that have higher or lower report card ratings. And again, this national data, when we look at the fourth grade reading scores, Milwaukee is going to be among the widest gaps in the country, very similar on other tests and other disciplines. So that's been a place where the city has really struggled and continues to struggle.
What kind of reactions has this report gotten?
I think people are sobered to hear the stats all over again. I know for me personally, so I came into this work for the first time about 14 years ago, and it has been dispiriting, to say the least, of how little has changed. And I think sometimes a report like this is hard to hear because you don't know what to do with it. And not that this is good news, but one kind of new data point that this report brought up for us and that we hope is of real interest to the public is there's actually one area in which we've gotten worse that maybe we didn't need to have gotten worse. Okay. And can get some additional attention toward, and that's chronic absenteeism. Mm-hmm. So this is the percentage of students who are missing over 10% of school days, which amounts to about 18 days or more per year. And in 2023, we had over 50% of MPS students missing over 10% of school days. The charter schools had around 37%. So this is something happening citywide that was not happening to the same degree before the pandemic. And so when you ask about public reception, like, well, there's a lot that feels really stuck. And then there's this new thing that is going to make all the other work harder, but also is relatively new and therefore feels like maybe it's something easier to change, that it's not a matter of having to reverse 30 years worth
sure.
of difficulties, but really reversing or addressing these couple of years in the pandemic recovery where students' relationship to school seems to have changed in a really concerning way.
There's been a lot of news and upheaval about and within MPS lately. And as a new school year is about to start, what do you hope this report can do for a lot of people, whether it's parents, teachers, staff, and especially policymakers?
I think it's perfectly understandable why MPS right now is receiving a lot of public attention and civic mobilization. And I hope that this report is part of broadening the opportunity to talk about Milwaukee's education scene, because we do have so many students who are not in MPS. And when we look outside of MPS, we have also great concerns about how well we're serving children. So being able to talk about Milwaukee's education scene from a really holistic vantage point that is talking about MPS, but is also talking about charter schools and is also talking about private schools and isn't solely looking at finance, but the very related pieces of enrollment, demographics, and performance. That was our hope here, was to really be able to give that holistic look that could inform anyone wanting to make change, whether it's at their school, their community, or from a broader policy perspective.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for coming in to talk about this and for all of the work that went into it with you and your colleagues. It's quite a feat, and I hope some people can really dive deep into this and get some takeaways.
That would be great. And for anyone not wanting to go through all 57 pages, we've got an executive summary and a press release, and have at it.
Thanks again. Sarah Shaw is the Deputy Research Director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. She joined me to talk about their recent report, Roll Call, a landscape review of the students, financing, and performance of Milwaukee's K-12 schools. You can listen to more of our conversation and find a link to the full report at wuwm.com. In about 10 minutes, we'll explore a book about Milwaukee by renowned historian John Gerda. But first, we'll learn about the efforts to stop the I-94 expansion project in Milwaukee. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The I-94 expansion project is facing a lawsuit. It argues the project would likely exacerbate racial segregation, that it won't alleviate congestion, and will increase air and noise pollution. The $1.7 billion project was approved in March. It will change I-94 between 16th and 70th Streets from 6 lanes to 8. Dennis Grzynski is one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs. He joins WUWM's Chuck Kornbach to share what this lawsuit is arguing is wrong with the highway plan.
One is the state's and the federal government's failure to consider an alternative like the coalition's Fix at 6 proposal, which would address safety and other problems in rebuilding the highway while putting in substantial investments in increased public transit, which would reduce the need for this massive expansion to 8 lanes and a huge interchange at the stadium, altogether taking up 54 more acres of the city for highway use. Problems with the project include it's going to fail to achieve its stated congestion reduction and safety goals. It's going to increase air and noise pollution. It will increase deaths and serious injuries from collisions. That's from the project's own data. It will reduce fender benders, but the important serious accidents are going to increase.
How does a project that ostensibly is for safety, how would it cause more serious accidents?
By adding another lane and inducing and encouraging people to drive faster. And when people drive faster, the collisions that they have are worse.
Your coalition has been fighting this for a long time. Why go to the level of a lawsuit? Why is it that important?
That's the only way at this point, attempting to get this project altered.
If you can, in lay terms, spell out the key legal arguments that are being made by your lawsuit.
Sure. One of them is that other alternatives like Fix-Up 6 were rejected because the agency said they won't fully address safety. They won't fully address the congestion reduction goals. Meanwhile, the alternative that they have chosen and are going to spend almost one and three quarter billion dollars on don't achieve those goals. So that's a legal problem. The environmental impact statement fails properly to address the many deficiencies of the project, does not include in the traffic projections that the agencies use to evaluate the whole range of alternatives, does not include the fact that if you build a bigger highway, people will take more trips. If you reduce congestion during the rush hour for the first few years, people will realize that it's faster to travel at rush hour, and trips that didn't make sense to take now become sensible to take. And those added trips will lead to both more collisions, more pollution, more noise, more harm that driving vehicles causes. The analysis of the impacts on legally protected groups, minorities, low-income, disabled individuals and communities in the environmental impact statement is inadequate. It's the same kinds of deficiencies that essentially led to a victory by the coalition when a somewhat similar lawsuit was filed 10 or 15 years ago about the zoo interchange project. And there are similar challenges that were raised on this project by the coalition in 2017. And the case was dismissed after Governor Walker asked the federal government to withdraw approval for the project.
But taking on the state and federal highway engineers must be a significant challenge. Can you do anything more than just win some additional options? Can you really win this case?
It is certainly possible. It would make sense, it seems to me, for the highway agencies to recognize that given the history of the zoo interchange case, a lawsuit challenging the Highway 23 expansion, which demonstrated that the state had essentially made up its traffic projections using a method very different from the method that it was publicly saying it was using, Sheboygan and Fond du Lac counties. It is reasonably likely that the plaintiffs will achieve some success with this case. And we can fight about this for a number of years. And it's, among other things, it's an opportunity for the transportation agencies to sit down and figure out what can be done to address these problems, both regarding this incredibly expansive design, far more than is needed, and to figure out a way of providing people in this area with the kinds of public transit services that they need and that they deserve, and that basically people in cities of our size elsewhere in the country expect and actually receive.
Well, finally, Dennis Grzynski, there is a federal civil rights review going on, we think. Why not wait for that review to complete before filing this lawsuit?
Well, the deadline for filing the lawsuit is Monday, August 19th. So it needed to be filed by then. Secondly, no one knows how quickly or slowly the Title VI civil rights case investigation will proceed. And the lawsuit and the civil rights investigation, while there's certainly a significant overlap, it's the same project. Some of the problems overlap. The legal requirements are different. The Civil Rights Act provides different remedies for different kinds of violations. The lawsuit provides different remedies for different legal deficiencies. So they're really two separate tracks. And, you know, I would say, again, while there's overlap, this is the same project. It has, you know, the same real world impacts, but they get viewed differently by the different proceedings.
Dennis Grzynski is one of the attorneys in a lawsuit trying to block the I-94 expansion project. He and other lawyers are representing Milwaukee Inner City Congregation Allied for Hope, 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin, the Sierra Club, and the Milwaukee Riverkeepers. Grzynski spoke to WUWM's Chuck Kornbach. For fans of Milwaukee history, there's one name that comes to mind as the leading expert on the city, John Goerda. He's written extensively about the city in his columns in the Journal Sentinel, his many books on the city, and even in the documentary series, The Making of Milwaukee. But his guide is perhaps the project most closely based on his life's work. John Goerda's Milwaukee is a guidebook to the city that provides detailed maps of routes through different Milwaukee neighborhoods. Goerda joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share more.
How did you develop this guide?
This began as a tour that I was leading for nonprofit groups, especially back in the 1970s, and did that for close to 50 years, and developed a route that I thought really kind of showed off Milwaukee at its most characteristic. And I always had, it wasn't quite a bucket list, but I knew that as I took people around the city, all this knowledge would kind of die with me if I didn't have, you know, some way of getting this into the public domain. So this project was born probably a year, 2 years ago, and it was essentially a means of downloading things I'd learned into a format that people could take the tour on their own. That's pretty much what it amounts to.
So in some ways, this is a project that started in the 1970s, but these are new maps, and a lot of the sites are relatively new, I would say. One that sticks out in my mind is Versity. That's one that was listed in there. But many of them, the majority of them, are historical sites.
They are. And I think it's important to underline that just as you can't step into the same river twice, you can't tour the same city twice. It's always changing. And what I said, the introduction to this, the guidebook, John Goerda's Milwaukee, was that I hope that someday people would look at this book, you know, dust it off, you know, 50 years from now, and look at it the same way I look at the WPA writer's guides from the 1930s, you know, kind of a take on a vanished city, but one that's pretty fascinating, you know, just kind of to see how much change there's been. And what it underlines is the basic dynamism of the city as an organism, which I think is always fascinating, you know, in Milwaukee and everywhere else.
Now, there are so many neighborhoods in the city of Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. It would be impossible to have a guide of this size, of this kind, and get to every neighborhood. How did you decide which neighborhoods to include in the guide?
It was a matter of looking at a blend of manageability and variety and diversity. So certainly you got to start downtown. That's where the heart of Milwaukee is. And you certainly have to do west side, north side, east side, south side. You know, so you kind of begin with those cardinal points and look at what you can do in a half day and say this is kind of the mix of neighborhoods and landmarks that's going to show people, you know, what Milwaukee is, who Milwaukee is.
Well, and is that the goal, that someone's going to take this guide and really spend the day with it and go through all of these neighborhoods?
My intention, my hope is that people, you know, if you're on a bike, probably best spend over a couple of days. But you can do this in a half day in a car without a great deal of trouble. Probably don't start at rush hour. Although in Milwaukee, some of the bus tours I lead would be after work. And we leave at 5 and get back at, I don't know, 7:30 or 8. And Milwaukee is such a manageable city, such a human scale city, that you can do that. You know, in Chicago, you know, it would be completely impossible. So yes, I think this should be one experience, and people can certainly, you know, this is linear, so you can chop it up into as many segments as you want. You know, spend an hour every Saturday, kind of poking around town. So I think people may do it sequentially, or they may do it all in one gulp. But my hope is that they kind of come back with an enlarged sense of what Milwaukee is, and again, who Milwaukee is, and also, you know, kind of a sense of the diversity and the vitality. As I said near the end of the tour, there's no section of Milwaukee that this tour touches on that does not have some signs of new life, energy, you know, dynamism again.
This guide is largely specific routes through neighborhoods. There are maps for each neighborhood and instructions, you know, turn left at this street,
right,
pull over here or there. What do you think that kind of specificity gives to a person who's exploring the city?
I think it provides kind of a through line from which they can deviate. So you start with, you know, pretty much it's a real sloppy figure eight. You know, so it kind of winds around downtown, west, north, and east, and comes across through the Third Ward into Walker's Point, Southside, Bayview. So I think it provides kind of like the armature for a sculpture. You know, it's kind of it's the outline, it's the bones, it's the skeleton of an urban experience. But certainly, you know, if people want to get lost, they should absolutely feel free to do so, and that can often be rewarding. But what this does is, I hope, gives people some confidence that you can get from here to there, you know, without getting too mixed up, too lost.
Fairly manageable in a city like Milwaukee.
Right, exactly.
Now, of course, this is a guide that is specific, does have maps, does include specific sites, but it also includes just information about the neighborhoods themselves. How much would you say this balances what is visible and what is, you know, invisible in the neighborhood, kind of the history, the things that were there?
Good question. I think the emphasis here is very pronouncedly kind of on the human side of the city. You know, so it's about the people who lived and live, and both lived and live, you know, in all these neighborhoods. So I've always said the past, history is why things are the way they are. The past and present are always kind of commingled. So I think when people see, they go down to Pigsville and they say, you know, here we are on Menominee Rivers right here, and get some sort of working class housing. But it kind of takes you back to kind of what the origin story is, why that neighborhood is named the way it is, why people settled there in the first place. And as well, I think people could read this this could be armchair touring as well. So there are kind of capsule histories of Milwaukee's Black community, Milwaukee's Latino community, the Polish South Side, or the German North Side. So there are, in a lot of ways, it's kind of a distillation of things I've learned over the last 50 years.
There are a lot of neighborhoods that people are going to be familiar with. There's going to be, you know, downtown. Most people have been downtown, Bayview, Walker's Point. What are some of the neighborhoods that you're really excited for people to explore where they haven't maybe been before?
Depends on where you live. You know, so Southsiders sure. Should know the North Side, and North Siders should know the South Side. You know, we should have that kind of reciprocity going on. But when I would do the bus tours or other vehicles from trolleys to limousines, Pigsville was always a hit because you can't get there unless you're going there on purpose or you're lost, you know, down there in the Menominee Valley. That was always a treat. And there are, 11 streets there, 7 end and dead ends. So you can see the whole thing. You know, you can do a comprehensive overview of Pigsville. But some of the ones that I think are fascinating, you get around Lindsay Heights on the north side, you know, kind of see the German origins and then becoming an African-American community over the years. And some of the developments on the north side, Halyard Park, Bronzeville, Brewers Hill, Harambe, there's a lot going on there. And I think people who have not been there for a while will kind of say, oh, there's something interesting going on. And conversely, on the south side, one story that always, you know, got people sort of say, what? Was my grandmother was raised on 14th Street, a Polish immigrant family, and on her lot there were 5 houses and 27 kids, you know, so 3 baseball teams. And that never fails to get at what? So that is very apparent in the landscape. You know, you see all these Polish flats on the south side, and you say, my, that was an extraordinarily dense neighborhood that had an extremely strong sense of place.
For sure. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure, Joy.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian and the author of many books on the topic, including John Gerda's Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers last year. We'll take one more break, then return to learn about the history of the great circus parade tradition here in Milwaukee. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. 60 years ago, the Great Circus Parade filled the streets of downtown Milwaukee with colorful, historic wagons, marching bands, and clowns. The parade showcased Wisconsin's history as the birthplace of many circuses, and the unique collection of wagons housed at the Circus World Museum in Baraboo. Over the years, the parade repeatedly returned to Milwaukee with the final hurrah in 2009, after a long and extremely expensive run. This might all sound like ancient history to people who never experienced the spectacle, but as WUWM's Susan Bentz discovered, the parade's memory lives on today.
Milwaukee Public Librarians Jennifer Paul and Dan Lee are busy preparing to show off the library's Great Circus Parade collection.
The last one was 14 years ago, and that was the swan song of the circus parade. And there's a whole generation that has never grown up with the circus parade. Jen Paul is our digital projects librarian, and she thought, well, you know, since it's the 60th anniversary, let's digitize some of the materials that we have.
Lee has personal parade memories. We're standing on Wisconsin Avenue, where he and his parents watched the splendor in the 1970s.
Yeah, we would have lunch at Big Boy, and looking out the window, you could see that there were already rows of people, you know, camping out on Wisconsin Avenue waiting for the parade to start, so that the rows were about like 5 deep already. And then when we would finish our lunch, and then we would try to, you know, find a spot and squeeze our way in where we can actually see part of it.
We meet digital projects librarian Jennifer Paul a few blocks west on Wisconsin Avenue inside Milwaukee's majestic Central Library. Paul pages through some of the materials donated over the years, including a box chucked full of slides from the first and second parades.
One of the slides included the wagon that contained the hippopotamus, which didn't start being pulled in the parade until 1964.
Paul says parade organizers kept meticulous records of every element of the parade. She has digitized that too. That means with a click, people can peruse the materials from the screen of their choice. Digitizing also protects posters, flyers, tickets from deteriorating.
We have an itinerary that lists descriptions of all of the different circus wagons that were in the parade.
That very first time.
And it includes like the number of horses that pulled them, colors that the wagon was painted, circuses that they came from, so just a wealth of information.
It was Lee's job to artfully fill 2 glass-covered display cases with memorabilia. He included something personal, a framed photo his dad had taken of Lee and his mom on the lakefront grounds where the circus wagons and animals lived over the days before and following the parade.
I wish I asked my dad why he chose to frame that photo. you know, of all the family photos that we have, you know, it was in my parents', you know, bedroom. And when my mom went into assisted living, I placed it there as a, you know, as a little memento. And it's back home now. And I figured, geez, you know, I'm setting up a display on the circus parade. I figured be nice to, you know, have that in there.
For me, the photos, some of the photos have a personal connection too.
Jennifer Paul moved from Michigan after the circus parade era, but inherited photos her uncle left to her.
In the 1960s, the late 1960s, I think it was 66, 67, he had come up from Chicago to attend the circus parade.
Two of those photos are on display,
including the one with the clown and the llama. So those are really some of my favorites, just because it's a connection to my uncle who's no longer with us.
Countless people cherish memories of one or more of the 29 circus parades held in Milwaukee. Jake Ruby is one of them. He grew up on the family farm in Brookfield and has vivid memories of circus parades. Horses were his dad, Rollins' passion. Jake sat beside his father as he drove six of his cherished draft horses in the first circus parade.
Chappie Fox headed up the museum up there, and it was his plan and his idea to have a circus parade, to bring it back after all these years. And so in doing that, he did need some help on getting the horsemen.
Dozens of teams of massive horses were needed to pull the restored antique circus wagons.
Chappie knew his wagons, he knew the circus history, but as far as putting the parade together, you know, obviously he had all the wagons and everything, but he needed people that could drive their horses and be safe. That's where my dad was just so vital to Chappie, and Chappie was very thankful to have him, because my dad basically screened every driver and every team in the first parade. He just didn't want there to be trouble with someone with wanting to be in the parade, because, you know, it was a big buildup to it, but not having the correct horses that had been around, or he had been around, you know, so.
The Rubies, father and son, showed and competed with their horses throughout the Midwest. Jake says his dad knew which horsemen had the most seasoned teams.
Figuring it out, the route, as far as turns, as far as the bridges being the old graded type where you can see through to the water. And things like that, you gotta be aware of what you're gonna do. Like for that, they laid down rubber mats so that the horses would not see through the bridge when they crossed it.
Rowland Ruby hitched up his horses for the final circus parade in 2009. He died only months later. Jake says simply,
it was the happiest time of his life when he was with his horses.
The South Milwaukee Municipal Band was among the ensembles chosen to march in the inaugural Great Circus Parade, and many of them that followed. I caught up with bass clarinetist Russ Deharsh recently when he and a much smaller and older municipal band performed at a local senior living facility.
I joined the band in 1969.
Over the years, the municipal band toured and played around the country. How does the circus parade compare?
It was a highlight in that it was like the biggest parade, and you got to be with other really big groups, and you knew it was important.
It was also hot and long, Deharsh says.
We bussed down to a lakefront, and then you had to wait for the circus people to give you your uniforms, because they owned the uniforms.
For that day, they became the Wild West Band.
You wore a Wild West shirt, you wore blue jeans, you had to wear plastic chaps they provided, and then a cowboy hat and a bandana on your neck.
Then the band waited until their time had come.
Once you stepped off, you never stopped playing. So most parades, they don't run that well. You start, you stop. Not in the Swift Parade. It was big time.
Joel Kempfer says he and his young son had a once-in-a-lifetime thrill while visiting the circus grounds in the early 1990s.
We were down at Veterans Park, just him and I. My daughter wasn't with us, or my wife wasn't with us for whatever reason. Of course, we were walking around the park, and we were excited to see that the 40-horse hitch had been, you know, they had the horses all hooked up to the wagon, and so we went closer to check it out.
Someone was supposed to be getting a ride, but hadn't shown up.
And the gentleman who was driving the horses looked at my son and I and says, hey, would you like a ride? And, you know, of course, we said, sure.
Kempfer has only one regret. His son was too young to remember their lap around the grounds behind the magnificent team of horses.
This is my wig. Oh, great. And my hat.
I had the chance to meet Linda Shipman face to face. Sitting in her shaded backyard in Germantown, she pulls out the costume she wore in the circus parade.
My favorite are my shoes.
Shipman is petite, but these shoes are supersized. That's because she was a clown, Noodles the clown. She and her fellow Milwaukee Metro Clown Club members waved to the mass of humanity throughout the parade route. In July 1994, her white face, artfully made up by Shipman herself, was on the front page of the Milwaukee Journal.
One of the favorite things that I used to do in parades was I'd be walking down the street and I'd see an empty lawn chair. And I'd plunk myself down in this lawn chair and I'd go, I hear there's a parade here today. Have you seen anything? You know?
Shipman says kids loved it, but the circus parade had different rules.
The circus parade was different than other parades. Baraboo wanted clowns in the parade. They didn't want them, how can I explain that? They wanted them there for show. They wanted them there for color. They didn't want us to talk to the people.
No props, no interaction.
There were a lot of don't in that parade.
Being a circus parade clown meant getting up at 5 a.m. and being on the grounds by 6. But Shipman says, don't get it wrong.
Once you put on the makeup, you almost become a different person. And I'd do it, if I was younger, I'd do it again in a heartbeat. It was like, they'd say, oh, circus parade is back. And
each conversation with people who stood in awe from the sidelines or played a role in the parade agreed. The Great Circus Parade was a highlight in Milwaukee's cultural history. For Like Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
That piece was produced by WUWM's Susan Bentz last summer. You can find out more about the Circus World Museum and the parade at WUWM.com. And that's Like Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Like Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Like Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Like Effect, we'll explore how the public is reacting to having our first presidential nominee who is a woman of color. That's tomorrow at noon on Like Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.